Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everybody out there. Welcome to tonight's special edition of Scott Scope Talk Radio. I am your host, Scott Wilson, blogger and graffiti writer extraordinaire. Tonight's date is August the 20th, 2015. On tonight's show, we're going to be talking to writer, filmmaker, pop culture critic, and black exploitation expert, David Walker. You probably might not want me to describe him in that way, but that's how I came to know his work. David's going to be joining us momentarily. We're going to be asking him about some of the stuff he's been doing lately, including writing Cyborg for DC Comics. The character now has his own solo title, and David is the one behind it. It's a very good book. I suggest everybody goes out there to check it out. We'll also be talking to him about the Shaft comic that he did for Dynamite Comics, which I think is now available in a collected trade paperback edition, in collected trade paperback form. We're going to be talking about his opinions about the upcoming Shaft movie that is being planned. We're going to be talking to him about a whole lot of things. At the top of the show, what I would like to do is offer the guest call-in number for anybody who may want to participate in this discussion. The call-in number is 347-215-7756. Again, that is 347-215-7756. And without further ado, wow, my cue was just lighting up. I think everybody just sort of came in at once. Okay, what I'm going to be doing here is I think I see David Walker on here, and I'm going to be bringing him in, and I'm also going to be bringing in my two co-hosts. David.
Yes, how are you?
David, thank you. Thank you so much for calling in, man. Thanks for doing this show with me. I've been a fan of your work for a while. I interviewed you for my blog, and we've talked a few times outside of that. But, hey, man, I'm glad to have you here.
Thanks for having me, man. It's the pleasure is all mine.
Okay, let me just bring on my co-hosts, one of which happens to be our resident DC Comics fan and expert, because I know he's going to have some questions for you.
All right, well, I'll answer them as best I can.
Okay, Rowdy, you there?
Hey, what's happening? What's going on, folks? How's everybody doing?
All right.
And doing good.
We're going to bring in...
Mr. Walker, how are you, sir? I'm bowing down to your altar as we speak. Let's get this going.
All right, well... Hopefully I won't disappoint y'all. That's all I
have. And David, I also want to introduce you to another Scott Scope Roundtable panelist, Miss E. Hill, a very intelligent and very formidable, intellectually formidable woman. E. Hill?
All right, well.
Wow. Okay, hi. So how can I hope I can live up to that, but this is all about you guys, and I'm just a fan right now. So learning more about comics and the characters, and so I'm looking forward to the discussion. Welcome.
Okay.
Thank you.
Let's get to it. Now, David, how about you just give a quick introduction for anybody listening who may not know much about you or your work?
Well, my name is David Walker, and I write comics. I'm currently writing Cyborg for DC. Just came off of a run of Shaft for Dynamite Entertainment. Done some independent stuff for Dark Horse and some self-published stuff as well. IDW. Used to be a journalist, film critic, all that fun stuff. But now I put all my energy into just writing comics and just trying to keep from going crazy, that's all.
Aren't
That's
we all?
The short version.
Aren't we all trying to keep from going crazy? So basically, now you're putting your energies into creating instead of simply evaluating what others create.
Yeah. That's a really good, succinct answer or way to sum it all up. I mean, I still will look at stuff critically and talk about it from time to time, but as far as, you know, writing stuff or actively being, now I'm just like everybody else. I've got an opinion. If you ask me it, I'll share it with you, but I'm not writing like 1,000-word articles anymore. So it's too difficult to balance being creative and being a critic.
As time goes on, I'm beginning to relate more and more to that position. It definitely is very hard to balance all those things at once, keep all those plates spinning in the air. But now your background is not limited to, but is largely, and you used to have a magazine called The Badass Mofo, which is how I became familiar with you. I remember buying an issue of it back in 2002 in the Virgin Megastore in Times Square. And that magazine focused largely on exploitation and grindhouse films, right?
Yes, with a big emphasis on blaxploitation films. That was always the primary focus. Everything else was secondary.
Right. So the emphasis was on blaxploitation, and in a way, you were kind of known for that for a time, correct?
Yeah, and I think to a certain extent, I'm still known for it. Not as much as. Probably not as much as I used to be. The internet sort of changed a lot of things. You know, now there's different websites and groups on Facebook or whatever. But, you know, I'll still say that I've forgotten more than everybody else has remembered. And that's combined, you know. So I'm still the man, if that's what you're getting at. I'm still the man.
Definitely, like Shaft, you're still the man. You're still the man. A badass mofo,
yep.
as the title of your magazine and your site says. Oh, all right, great. I know Rowdy is chomping at the bit with some of his DC questions, and I'm going to say right now, we're not going to ask you anything that's going to put you in the hot seat. So, don't
worry. Well, let's just say this way. If you ask, it doesn't mean I'll be able to answer it. So
right,
I'll let
right.
you know. I'll yell out a safe word or something.
Right. Because one thing a lot of us fanboys tend to forget is that this is not just an art form that we enjoy consuming. This is a business.
Yeah.
And guys like David are not simply just artists who create whatever they want. Guys like you are under a considerable amount of pressure when you are working with these well-known commodities, especially one that's going to be present in the next big superhero film for DC, right?
That's what they tell me. To be honest with you, I don't even concern myself with any of that stuff. It's like my eyes are just focused on the comic world, and that's it.
Okay. All right. So yeah, how about we open the floor? How about we open the floor to a few questions about Cyborg, because I know that's what a lot of people want to know about right now. And before we continue, Dave, I don't know what your time window is for tonight. So I don't want to have you on here longer than you have to be. So we'll try to keep it concise.
All right.
I got
a little bit of time. I'm good for now.
Okay. Good. Great. All right. Now as for Cyborg, issue number one came out. Great job, by the way. Phenomenal job.
Thank you.
You know, for those who don't know, he's taken a character that most superhero comic book readers could have cared less about before. Pardon my French, Rowdy, if that's blasphemy to a DC Comics fan, but a lot of people.
I'll deal with you later. Just keep going.
Okay. A lot of people didn't care about before, and you've made him relevant. You know, you've kind of breathed new life into him, and you've brought him into the spotlight. How did you get this job? Like, how did this come? How did this connection come about?
Well, DC reached out to me well over a year ago. It might have actually been 2 years ago now. I can't even remember. But they reached out to me on a couple occasions and just didn't work out. And then probably it was around this time last year, maybe a little bit later in the fall, they reached out to me again and said, you know, we want to talk to you about pitching some stuff. And I was like, okay, you know, I'm ready. And they threw out the names of some characters, and all of them were really interesting characters. Cyborg was one of them. And I, you know, and I thought, yeah, they'll never let me do Cyborg, you know. But I threw together pitches for all these characters, and that was the one they liked the most. And so then we began the process of refining the pitch, you know, figuring out how it, you know, the direction the story would take, all that sort of stuff. And then the rest, they say, is history, you know. I mean, it was, it there's nothing, like, really fancy or exciting about it other than the fact that, you know, there's conversations going back and forth. And just really, you know, me saying a lot of my feelings about the character and what would be interesting and what I thought would need to would be needed to sustain the character in a solo book. Because there's a big difference between a character who's on a team, which is Cyborg, what Cyborg's been since he was created back in 1980, and then what's required of a character when they're carrying their own book. And that was the big thing with me. I was, you know, and a big thing with DC, which was like, you know, a lot of this is going to be about world building, and I enjoy doing that sort of stuff.
Okay, all right. I'm gonna let Rowdy ask a question or two, and also Miss E Hill, because I think now both of them kind of have a good idea of what you do and what's going on with Cyborg. So Rowdy, take it away.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm well. Right now, I'm about to lose my mind, but we'll get to that later. Scott already touched on Cyborg, and I'm not even you know, I'm pretty sure we'll come back to it later on. But when he told me that you were coming on the show tonight, the first thing that came to my mind actually was a book that you had written called Becoming Black,
okay.
Personal Ramblings. First of all, if anybody here who has not read that book, especially anybody who are big fans of pop culture, you know, comics and film or whatever, get that book, read that book, absorb that book. That book is awesome.
Thank you very much.
You're
welcome. Yes, it is. Great, great book. I read it as well. Insane book.
It's very insane. It is. What was your drive behind that book? Because, I mean, a lot of the things you speak on, a lot of things you touch on are things that, you know, as minorities, it constantly gets talked about then and now. I mean, the book is about, what, 2 years old come November, if I remember correctly? So,
yeah,
I mean,
about
these
2 years,
Yeah, so this is stuff that's still going on. What was your drive, what was your motivation to write a book like that, to bring that out in the forefront?
It was, interestingly enough, I'd gone back to school. I dropped out of college, like somewhere around my sophomore year, back around 1990. And then in 2010, I decided to go back to school and finally get my undergrad degree. And I needed a senior project. And so I was talking to my advisor, and I majored in interdisciplinary studies. And it was very much a self-designed curriculum. And so my advisor was like, well, what would you really like to do? And I said, well, you know, I've got these ideas in my head to write about how pop culture and racial ideology cross paths, how they cross paths historically, and how they shape who we are and how we think about ourselves and how we think about race. And I'd like to do just a collection of essays and then self-publish them. And he was like, self-publish them? And I was like, yeah, because if I'm going to put this much energy into writing them, I want to have a book. I want to have something out there for people that they can read if they so choose, or that I can hand to people. So that was it. I wrote that all. I think there's 8 or 9 essays in there, and I wrote them all over the course of a single semester. And
wow.
And it was hard. It was not easy. a lot of hard work, but a lot of it was, you know, stuff that I'd been talking about for a long time, that I'd written about in the past, but I was trying to put it into something a little bit bigger, like looking at things from a much bigger picture. So, you know, I like the there's an essay in there about kung fu movies and the impact they had on the black community.
Right.
This is all stuff I talked about before, but never, you know, in anything that would have resembled a serious context. You know, there, you know, nothing with academic citations or anything like that. And same with like the chapter called "Why Does the Brother Gotta Die?" I'd actually published an essay, that same essay. I published an earlier version of that essay probably like 3 years before. And then I decided to really beef it up and really get into like, just start uncovering stuff. Because this is stuff we've all talked about. You know, you get together with your folks, you know, you watch a movie, you read a comic, you read a book, and you go into these conversations. Those conversations seldom go as deep as I'd wanted them to. So that was sort of what the decision was, to write these pieces.
Wow, that's, and you said that you did that over a semester. So what? That was about like what, 4 months, give or take?
Yeah, about
if you figure
3.5-4 months. Yeah, because when you add in the procrastinating and waiting to the last minute, I probably did it all in like 3 months. And then after I was done, I took some time to, you know, to lay the book out, to design it, all that sort of stuff. But yeah, that from start to finish, from start to the time I actually had a physical copy in my hand, was less than 5 months.
Wow.
Mm. Wow.
But I don't know if I can do that again, because that took that took a lot out of me.
I could have, yeah. I can only imagine. That's insane. That's insane, considering how well that book is written, how great that book is, for you to do that in that time frame. That says a lot. It really does. It really does. So, yeah, kudos to you on that one. Definitely.
Thank you.
Gus, sorry, Scott.
Rowdy, just, I got a question for you. A quick question for you. Did you read that book off of my recommendation, or did you just pick it up yourself?
Well, it was a little bit of both. I remember you and I had talked about it, and around the same time you and I were talking about it, I was hearing rumblings and, you know, from other people who are, you know, pop culture fans, kung fu fans, and things of that nature. And, you know, it was just like, okay, well, you know, Scott and I talked about it, and I have all these other people talking about it, and, you know, I got to check out this book. I got to see what's really good, you know. So being able to have access to books, to get to books the way I can through my job, I was like, okay, you know, I'm going to get this book and give it a read and check it out. And, you know, so be it. And you had a chance to read that book, and it was just like, I couldn't put it down. I think I finished it, you know, like 2-3 days, because, you know, in between, there's, you know, I still got to read some comics. But, you know, between the book, you know, between that, I think I finished in like 2-3 days, and it was just like, wow, this is just awesome. You know, I always recommend that book to anybody and everybody, especially if you're a fan of anything pop culture related. I always say, you know, you got to give this book a shot. You have to check it out.
So just to be clear, Scott Scope is now officially part of David Walker's PR department. So any questions you have about his work, you can bring to us. E-Hill, do you have any questions?
Well, I'll admittedly state up front that I'm a novice to this whole area of pop culture, but I think I've always had a bit of a question. Now that you bring up the writing process, I'm very familiar with the writing process and writing chapters of a book in a short amount of time. So I can anchor my question based on my experience with that. So I know that writing is very iterative. So how do you balance the drawing and the writing, the iterative processes, which I'm sure drawing is? How do you balance that within the time frames that you're given to produce the product?
Oh, well, with comics, it's simple, because I don't actually draw them. I just write them.
Oh,
and,
okay.
I will sometimes do little like thumbnail doodle sketches, whatever you want to call it, to help me visualize how the book could, if a page can be laid out, if a scene can be laid out a specific way. But when I'm writing a script, it's just really, when I'm writing a script for a comic book, it's just really putting it together and then hoping that the artist can come up with something really cool and innovative to translate my words into images. And with some artists, they're with you throughout the whole process. So they'll send you ideas and thumbnails and you can, you know, offer some feedback. And then other artists, I don't know what it's going to look like till I've seen it. It varies from artist to artist, varies from publisher to publisher. It even varies from editor to editor. So, but the whole visual component certainly for me plays in big, because, like, I'll be honest, as a comic book fan, if the art isn't working, it doesn't matter how good the writing is for me.
Right.
It's really all right about the art. So
definitely. All right. Yeah, I have a question I just thought of. Well, a few more actually, but I have a question that just came to mind in regards to, because I don't want to keep it all about Cyborg and DC. Okay,
why not? But why not? But you know, it's your show.
Yeah, it's my show, and my show is Marvel territory. This is Marvel country.
Okay.
Right. This is just like how you have East Coast bias in hip hop. This is Marvel bias. Anyway. we'll definitely have a question, some more questions about Cyborg. But I want to talk a bit about Shaft. You did
okay.
Shaft for Dynamite Comics, right?
Yeah.
And you know, for anybody listening again, I have to put on my PR cap for David Walker. If you have not read Shaft, if you like any of those comics from the 70s, like Luke Cage, you know, any of the black characters that Marvel used to do during the 70s, the two or three that they had, if you like any of those, you need to check out Shaft. If you like pulp novels, you need to check out Shaft. If you like blaxploitation, you need to check out Shaft. If you like all of the above, you need to check out Shaft. David Walker and his artist, whose name escapes me at the moment. Oh, who's your artist again, David?
Vilkis Everly.
Yes. Yes. The art, the writing are insane, and you need to check out that book. It's out in trade paperback now, right?
Comes out in October. Trade paperback in October.
Okay, right. But
pre-order it now. That's what you got to do.
Yeah, that's what you got to do. Or if not, you can pre-order the individual issues off of, at places like Comixology, or you can go to your local comic shop and get the hard copy. But you did that for Dynamite, and you also did a novel, right?
Yeah, the novel comes out in. They tell me it's coming out in December, so that's Shaft's Revenge. So the Shaft trade paperback October, the novel December.
All right. Now, recently, you were kind of involved in, like, a public discourse with which studio acquired the rights to Shaft?
New Line.
New Line acquired the rights to Shaft, and they wanted to put out a comedic reboot of the character, and you had some issues with that. Can you kind of fill us in on that whole discourse?
You know, I just I shot off my mouth. They announced that they were doing a movie that was going to be comedic. And I got really upset with that for a whole host of reasons. So I wrote a piece that I posted on my blog. And I still hold by everything I said in that open letter, which was that, you know, this isn't really something that... Shaft isn't something that needs to be a comedy or should be comedy, and you know, we don't have a lot of iconic characters, black characters in pop culture. There are no franchises in film that are led by black actors. There's a couple that are comedic. There's some comedic franchises. There's, you know, obviously the Men in Black films, and then there's the Friday films. But even most of those we haven't seen any in a long time. And so to take this really iconic character and then just turn him into something comedic, to me, is a disservice, especially in a time when we're not seeing much in terms of heroism, black heroism on screen. There's black dysfunction, and there's black, comedies, but there's not much in terms of just, like that stuff that we see all the time with white characters. There's, the Avengers movies, and there's, Superman movies and Batman movies, and there's the Mission Impossible movies, and there's all these franchises, but then there's really not much for us.
Wow. That's like one of the most concise summations I've heard of the whole situation in a long time.
Yeah.
Now, as far as what your vision for Shaft was while doing this series for Dynamite and doing this novel, what was that vision?
It was, what I did is I went back to the original source. See, a lot of people don't realize that before there was a movie, there was a novel, and there was 7 novels in all by Ernest Tidyman. And so I went back to those to really sort of get a handle on who that character was within the world of pulp fiction. They were very, pulp thrillers. And I drew two or three biggest aspects of that character was that, he was a Vietnam vet, that he had gone into the Marines when he was only 17 years old because he'd been arrested and the judge had given him the option of going to prison as an adult or going into the military. So he opted to go into the military as a kid, went off to Vietnam where he became a battle-hardened soldier. And that concept of a character who's a young black man who gets caught up in the prison industrial complex, but instead opts to go into the military industrial complex and then comes out of it a killer, is endlessly fascinating to me. And it's something that they never touched upon in 4 films and a TV series. They never touched upon any of that. And I felt that was a shame because at the core of that character is something that speaks to, I think, a lot of black folks, especially young black men. It spoke to them back then in the late 60s, early 70s, and it still speaks to us today when it seems like, what are two of the, most realistic options for poor young black kids, and it's it's the military, or you get caught up in, you get caught up in that endless cycle of prison, of correctional facilities. And again, that's why I don't think making this a comedy is a good idea. Because there's all kinds of relevant things that can be mined within that character, that can be explored within that character. And yet, we're going to, make light of everything. And I just, there's just no need to do that.
Now, speaking of making light of issues with fictional black heroes, in your book Becoming Black, there was something you touched on in your piece about the relationship that black audiences during the 1970s and even still today have to martial arts movies, particularly the ones that come from Hong Kong, which at one time was like one of the world's biggest film industries. There was a point that you made in that piece that I tried to relate to my girlfriend, and I couldn't find the right words. I couldn't be as eloquent as you were. you talked about, because a lot of people don't realize that blaxploitation pictures and the martial arts movies in the 1970s, or chopsockies, or as they're sometimes known, that's kind of a derogatory term, or also karate movies, as we call them up in New York. They the heroes in those movies had something that the heroes in blaxploitation movies did not always have. Can you elaborate a bit on that for me?
Yeah, it's and it's interesting because I had trouble articulating it for the longest time, and then I read RZA's memoir,
The Tao of Wu. Yeah.
Tao of Wu, and yeah, and so he was talking about it, and he articulated it in a way that helped me expand on what I was getting at, which is what I found interesting whenever I was watching, kung fu movies. Especially my favorite kung fu movie of all time is 36 Chambers of Shaolin. also known as Master Killer. So the first, 10 times I saw it as Master Killer. And then, then I finally saw it as 36 Chambers of Shaolin. But in a lot of these movies, a lot of these Shaw Brothers movies, the character that we see, the characters are always out for revenge. And they're always out for revenge against some sort of oppressor or oppressive system. You saw this not just in the Shaw Brothers movies, but it was also big in the Golden Harvest movies, which Golden Harvest, Raymond Chow's company did, like Bruce Lee's movies when he was in Hong Kong in the 70s. And the interesting thing about all these characters is that they exist in a world where they have a history outside of that oppression that is keeping them down. They come from a world in which they know their past, and they know that at some point in their past, they weren't always oppressed. And that's sort of what fuels the fire within them. It fuels the rebellion. It fuels the revenge. Whereas in blaxploitation movies, the heroes always exist in a world within a context of oppression, meaning they have no knowledge of themselves outside of this construct of oppression that we all live in. And that speaks to a bigger problem with America in real life and black folks in real life, is that most of us don't have a knowledge of self. And by knowledge of self, I don't just mean who I am, but who I am and where I come from. Most of us might know our parents or our grandparents, but they can't trace their family lineage back 5 or 6 generations. And part of that is because just the disease of slavery makes it almost impossible to do that. So it's very difficult for black Americans to conceive of themselves, to have a knowledge of self outside of this construct of oppression and slavery. And without that, you're fighting for something, but you don't know what you're fighting for. And in the kung fu movies, they always knew what they were fighting for because they understood who they were before they became oppressed. I think that says it. I think I hit that.
Oh, yeah, you did. That's pretty much dead center. And our resident academic and intellectual on here, E. Hill, I know she has a question about this. She has to have a question on this. So, E. Hill, please, if you will.
Oh, wow. as I sit here on the spot, I think that's a very interesting connection to make. I probably would not have made it without that very eloquent explanation. So if you were to make something or create or have input on the creation of a modern day movie, show, something, how would you incorporate, now given our history as a people, and we have some things to reach back to, even in recent history,
yeah.
How would you incorporate that concept in something of and for black folks?
That's a really good question. You know, I wrestle with that a lot.
Oh, that's great, because I was like, whoa, I got to think of something. And reasonably intelligent. So, thank you.
You know, it's interesting because the key is that people, when they watch movies, we'll talk about it specifically within the context of movies. When people watch movies, they watch movies to be entertained. They don't watch movies to be preached to, for the most part, or to be lectured, for the most part. They want to go and just have a good time. And that's why, you know, movies like Jurassic World make $1 billion. They want to see people fighting dinosaurs or whatever. And I think in that regard, you know, if there were more movies that just had, you know, black characters in roles that weren't subservient or degrading or negative, then you know, some of what we're talking about, not all of it, some of what we're talking about might not be as crucial. You know, to give you an example, the Fast and Furious movies are not, I don't think, are great movies. They don't, you know, they're not necessarily doing anything other than providing escapist entertainment. But they also happen to have a really diverse cast, you know, people from, you know, all different shades and different ethnicities. And they're immensely popular worldwide. And, you know, Fast and Furious serves a need. It's feeding people who are very hungry for something very specific. And sometimes that's all a movie has to do, is just give you something to feed your entertainment hunger, feed your fantasy. Now, in terms of creating something that helps to develop knowledge of self, you know, that is a really good question, and I wrestle with that a lot as I am talking, as I'm writing projects and developing projects. And for me, it's about just creating characters who come to an awareness and knowledge of who they are and what their role within their environment, within their universe is. So if anything, what I'm trying to do is create characters that when people are reading, whether it's a book or a comic, will maybe inspire them to do some soul searching. So I don't necessarily get into, you know, genealogy or you know, understanding, right, you know, African, East African history. You have to be careful when we talk about the Atlantic slave trade, because when we're talking about the people who were impacted the most came from the eastern coast of the largest populated continent on the planet, not necessarily from the west coast of Africa or even along, say, the northeastern part of the state. The continent. See, I'm already making these mistakes. Referring to Africa like it's a tiny little place.
Well, I think it's an interesting notion to reach back, because there, I mean, Chinese history certainly is long and, I mean, spans millennia.
Yep.
But there are aspects of black history, I guess the most recent example I can think of is Selma, where you're dropped into a specific event and it's chronicling that event, but it stops and ends with that time, that event in that time period. It doesn't necessarily, you know, there's not necessarily a movie that links these various sentinel events in the civil rights movement and otherwise to things that are happening now. And I think it would be very interesting if somebody were thoughtful enough about it to assess those linkages in some kind of popular media.
No, it'd be really interesting because, you know, I mean, I think, like, you know, one of the problems that we're dealing with is that in America, I mean, we're still arguing over why the Civil War was fought. You know, and so it's like trying to get into anything that deals with history. There's still people out there that think Gone with the Wind is a reasonable and realistic representation of a time in American history, and it's a load of crap. You know, it's insidious propaganda. and filmed in Technicolor. And you know, when I talk about this in one of the essays, and I believe this very strongly, you know, it's I've had more arguments with people about Gone with the Wind than maybe any other movie other than the Star Wars films. And it's sort of unsettling to me because people, you know, think it's a great movie and they think that it's an accurate portrayal, not only of the Civil War, but of slavery. And it's like, okay, well, if this is where you're coming from, we got a problem. Because that's like trying to argue with somebody that thinks The Wizard of Oz is real life.
And Dave, and I really don't want to cut into what you're saying, but just to give people context so they understand, when you bring up Star Wars and Gone with the Wind, that's two things that are kind of closely related in a way, because those are the number one and number two movies of all time when adjusted for ticket price inflation. Those are the movies that have take the two movies in the most admissions at box offices in America. In North America, are Gone with the Wind number one and Star Wars number two. Now, I'm sorry, David. Please continue.
And Snow White's up there too. I can't remember,
yes.
but that's also sells a very particular fantasy that in which there are no black people present. You know, I mean, the first Star Wars movie, the first one, Episode Four, A New Hope.
Four.
there's no black folks in it. None.
And black people went to see it in droves. And if I remember you saying correctly, Star Wars was one of the movies that kind of killed the black exploitation cycle in a way. But again, I'm sorry. Please go ahead.
Yeah. But yeah. So you know, it's interesting to me because again, we're touching upon all of these issues that are much bigger. And am I saying that you can't be entertained by Star Wars? Am I saying that you can't be entertained by Gone with the Wind? This is part of, you and I were just talking the other day about this.
Yes.
And it's like, yeah, you can look at stuff. I mean, there's movies that I love that I remember my cousin and I, years ago, we were watching, it was either Dolomite or Human Tornado, right? This was like 20-something years ago. We watched it on VHS. He had just, him and his wife had just had their first kid. She had never heard of Rudy Ray Moore. Never heard of Dolomite, never seen the movies, and he was like, oh, yo, let's watch this together. And I was like, yo, man, I don't think you should show this to your wife. And he's like, oh, no, she'll love it. 10 minutes in, she's like, I thought she was going to kick me out of the house, you know, and it was a valuable lesson. And it's like, now I still love, you know, my favorite Rudy Ray Moore movie is probably Human Tornado. If it's not that, then it's Pee Wee Straw. But I understand that movie, especially as I get older. I understand it for what it is. I understand it for all the problems that it has. I'm talking problems from an ideological standpoint. And so I wouldn't necessarily watch that movie with certain people unless they were, you know, without at least warning them first or, you know, and then if they hated the movie, that'd be fine. Just don't mess up my good time. You know, it's like I remember years ago watching a movie with an old girlfriend of mine, and it was some horror movie, and she clearly read some essay about, you know, how horror movies were terrible and degrading to society and all these things, and I was just like, I'm just trying to watch a movie, you know. Sometimes that's all you're trying to do. And there's some people, you know, I'm not going to watch certain movies with my mom in the room, you know, or for that matter, with, say, my friend's kids in the room. It's about understanding the audience, and it's also about being intelligent enough to look at something and go, yeah, you know, it's almost like fast food, right? You know fast food isn't good for you, but you still eat it sometimes. Rudy Ray Moore movies may not be the best for you, but still you laugh at them sometimes.
Okay. At this juncture, Dave, you know, because again, I don't want to impose on your time like this. I made the length of the show 90 minutes because I wasn't sure exactly how much time we would have with you. So, you know.
I got another 15, 20 minutes I can give you for sure.
Sure. Okay. Great. And again, that's very much appreciated. And I've been forgetting. This conversation has been going so great that I've been forgetting to give the guest call-in number, but I guess people just want to hear what you have to say. They don't really have questions. Yes, 347-215-7756. Again, that's 347-215-7756. Now, in these last 15, 20 minutes we have with you, or however long, I kind of want to steer it back around to what I know people are concerned with right now, and that's Cyborg and some of the comic properties that you are going to be involved with. Now, in the case of Cyborg, what has the reaction to it been so far?
It's been overwhelmingly positive, and which, you know, I'm eternally grateful. There's been some negative criticism of it. There's been some negative feedback, and I tried to address that with some people, but what I realized that the difference between being a creative person and being, you know, a critic is that I only have so much time to address certain things, and there are people who have come at me with negative things to say about the comic or me personally, and it's like, okay, you know, I have to pick and choose what I'm going to address, what I'm going to deal with, versus I still have deadlines to meet. And then I think that a lot of people, there's some people who are just never going to be happy. They're always going to find something to hate or to be critical of. And there's nothing wrong with those people. You can do that. I do that. But I also can choose not to engage with them unless it's going to result in something positive. And you know, like, I'm not one of those people who says only black people can write black characters. You know, I'm not one of those people who says only women can write women characters. But there's some people who think that way. And they're more than welcome to think that way. But we're never going to be able to agree on that one. If that's where you're coming from, we're not going to be able to agree. We're going to have to agree to disagree. And so with the criticism that I've been getting, it's been really interesting because it's like, you know, there's certain things I think some people don't think about, which is like, you know, a single issue of a comic book is only 20 pages long. You know, how many scenes can you have within a single issue of a comic book? How many things can you deal with within those scenes? How many characters? How much? There's only so much that can be done in a single issue of a comic book that I think a lot of people don't even think about that. And then there's other aspects too. If I don't have 100% control over anything, you know, even when I'm doing creator-owned stuff, I've self-published, I'm still working with other art. I'm working with artists. I'm working with colorists. I'm doing all these things. It's like there's other people that are involved that will bring in their opinions. In some cases, they bring in, you know, corporate mandates. There's all kinds of things that have to be factored in. And when you're a critic, you don't necessarily think about some of those things. Because at the end of the day, we're all critics. Any person with an opinion is a critic. And we don't always think about that sort of stuff. But then the moment you go to the other side of the fence, you know what I'm saying? The moment, it's one thing to be sitting in the bleachers watching the game. It's another thing to be playing the game. And once you're playing the game, it's a very different dynamic.
Rowdy, I know you got some more Cyborg questions in you, or some more DC questions in you.
Well, you know, I was just thinking, you know, you had the run with Shaft, and then not too long after that, you're doing Cyborg. How did your run with Shaft have any influence in how you approach Cyborg in terms of your writing, you know, in the process?
Yeah, you know, that's a really interesting question, because with both of those characters, I wanted to get more into the heart and soul of who they were, not just what people think they are. You know, there's a lot of people who think they know who Shaft is because they've seen a couple movies. Some of those people may have read books, but the vast majority of them have only seen the movie. Some people have only seen the movie with Samuel L. Jackson, which isn't even really Shaft, you know? So it was interesting, because what I wanted to do with both of those characters was to explore what makes them tick and what, you know, the human side of them. And so in that regard, it was sort of this, I took the same approach with both of them. And it was like thinking, what do I want to see from these characters? What are the comics that I would like to read? Especially with Shaft, because Shaft has never been done as a comic before. With Cyborg, it was like, okay, how do I want to see this character outside of the Justice League or outside of the Teen Titans? And that's what influenced me or steered me as I was putting it all together.
Okay.
Wow. Okay.
Rowdy, you had something you want to add?
No. I mean, no. I'm still trying to soak all this in right now. But no, right now, you know, I'm maintaining.
David, for Rowdy, this is him kind of getting a peek into the machine that he's always been in awe of.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, you know, for me, this is like one of the highlights, you know, just for me, being a lifelong DC fan. You know, I've grown up on DC. You know, my mom my mother put me on the DC comics, because she, you know, she loves Superman and Batman and the whole DC family. So just to have this right now, you know, this is just awesome.
Well, cool. I'm glad.
Like, this is
the
moment where I actually text my mom. I'm like, Mom, I'm talking to David Walker right now. He's doing Cyborg. She just started laughing, you know?
That's awesome.
Dave, one thing I have to get your opinion on, and again, not to put you on the hot seat, but it's something that's kind of relevant right now. You're a pop culture critic, so I know you have some insight. You know, Straight Outta Compton just came out. It made twice its production budget back in its first weekend, which is impossible for pretty much any summer blockbuster to do because they cost so much. Yeah. There's also been sort of a resurgence of the furor over the misogyny in their lyrics, and now also Dre's past of domestic violence and violence against women. And there are people who feel that that's unfair to the group and unfair to Dre, and that those things should be left in the past, and that he's already answered for them. And then there are some people who feel that, no, these things have never been answered for, and the overall influence of the group and Dre's behavior have kind of created this very dark legacy. What's your take on that whole thing?
That's a good question and a difficult question, and I don't know if I have... I know that whatever I say will not sit well with some people, and I respect that. One of the things that I think is interesting, though, is first off, I think it's really important that we don't forget that Dr. Dre did the things that he did. You know, not just the Dee Barnes incident, but there was other incidents of violence in his past, violence against women. And the interesting thing is that there is an opportunity to talk about this in criticizing the movie. You can criticize Straight Outta Compton for not addressing that. In criticizing the movie, it creates an opportunity to talk about it and to talk about more than just the movie didn't show it. Because the movie's been made. Nothing's going to change that, right? You know, I've seen some people say, maybe there's going to be some deleted scenes on you know, the DVD, the Blu-ray.
The Blu-ray,
and
yeah.
I'm like, really? Let's see, Dre produced the movie. Do you really think he, like, that's something he wanted to do? So the key is that when we're being critical of things, when we're being critical of a work of art, whether it's a film or a book or a comic or a song or anything, that criticism is a great opportunity to start talking about things more than just that individual piece of work. So, you know, we can criticize Straight Outta Compton for not showing what it shows, what some people think it needs to show. But then we can move on to talk about other movies that don't do it, other books that don't do it, other music
yes.
that doesn't do it. And then,
right.
but this is just as important, then we have to talk about how do we shift the dynamic, right? Because let me tell you something. There's a movie that came out in the 90s, brilliant movie out of Australia. I haven't seen it in years. It was called Once We're Warriors.
Yes.
And it dealt with domestic violence and domestic abuse. And I don't know anybody who watched that movie and had a good time. You know, it goes back to when I was saying people don't want to go to the movies to be preached to or to be lectured to. It's how you deal with a subject like domestic violence, domestic abuse in film is it's important to be dealt with, but it's also important to understand that there's just a lot of people who won't go see that, who won't talk about that, who want to, I go to a movie to have a good time or whatever. I'm not saying I'm one of those people. I'm just saying that this is what we're up against. And so, again, how do we take the opportunities and being critical to talk about one thing, but then to move that conversation in a direction that's productive? And so here we are. We're 2 weeks. The movie's been out for a week now?
Not even a week.
But it's like we're still having the same conversation about what's wrong with the movie as opposed to what's wrong with our society, what's wrong with what are we dealing with in terms of misogyny? What are we dealing with in terms of domestic violence? What are we dealing with in terms of the patriarchy that says that, and I want to be very clear, I'm not saying this. I'm saying that our patriarchal society says that women are essentially second-rate citizens. You know, this is the message we're getting over and over again. How do we address that? How do we deal with that? And that's the thing that I think is troubling to me, because it's not just with this movie. It's not just with Straight Outta Compton. It's with, I see this with all kinds of movies. People will get upset about something, you know, but then they don't talk about the real issue behind it. You know, they're upset because the guy playing Human Torch is a black guy. Okay, we need to talk about racism. You know, and it's like, no, this isn't racism. Sure it is. What else could it be? Well, he was white in the comics, and that's just destroying the legacy. The legacy of what? John Wayne played Genghis Khan.
Right.
White people get to play whatever they want. Don't come at me with that. Come at me with, you want to understand why you're so racist. And then I can have a conversation with you, you know?
Right. And it's funny, because I was about to ask you about that particular thing you just brought up. In terms of, you know, the Human Torch in the latest Fantastic Four movie is black. And you see, in the Marvel films, they introduce those, you know, who aren't familiar with comics or whatever, Falcon, and they're working on Black Panther. And, you know, Marvel decided to go with the black Nick Fury as opposed to the white, you know, Nick Fury. How, you know, what is your feelings about that in terms of the films, you know, with some certain roles maybe being designed more for African-Americans, for blacks? Do we need to see more instances like what we saw with Fantastic Four, less of? Like, how should that be approached? And can the same be said about female characters? We don't get enough of those of female characters, and we sure as hell don't get enough of the black female characters that are in comics. How should that be addressed?
Yeah, seeing that Storm is the resident Comic-Con costume.
Yeah. Right, you know? Well, you're actually correct.
Yeah, no. And you know, here's the interesting thing, because the one rebuttal that people always go to is they say, well, you know, why don't you just create new characters? You know, why do you have to make Johnny Storm black? Why don't you just create new characters instead of having a black character or a woman play that? And the answer is real simple, because new characters don't sell well. And if I were to create a black character right now and, you know, get it published and get it out there and someone wanted to make a movie out of it, there's something about that recognition. And especially within the comics world, I don't really care. You know, people say, well, how would you feel if Shaft was done as a white guy? And I say, well, see, that's different, because there's only Shaft. You know, in the comic book world, we've got Cyborg, we've got Black Lightning. I mean, we could practically sit here in the next 2 minutes and name off all the major black characters at Marvel and DC, and we wouldn't hit more than a dozen. But if we start naming off all the white characters, we're going to get into the hundreds. And the fact of the matter is that we just don't have that level of representation. And if we have to get it somehow, our imaginations have to be fed. And again, you know, if you look at the history of comics, especially the last 30, 40 years, there's only been a handful of characters that have been introduced at any publisher that have really, truly endured. And I say that, it's like, I think Spawn, you know, is one of the last characters to be created in the last 20, 30 years. Spawn and Savage Dragon, you know, they've endured over at Image. But, like, you know, let's try to think of characters, especially during the 90s and the early 2000s, that were created at Marvel and DC that not characters that have been reinvented, but characters that were introduced completely 100% new.
Right.
And so I don't have a problem with it. I want to see more films that are driven by women characters, by people of color, but most importantly, I want them to be good movies. You know, I don't want to watch a movie where, you know, you got the black lead and then the movie's his booty, you know, or there's something with a woman in it, and it's just like you're rolling your eyes. You're like, oh, this is just terrible. But there's definitely ways to do it. And you know, the thing is that I personally think everybody is too attached to all the characters that they love. I mean, I am. I certainly am. I got upset when they said they were making Shaft into a comedy. So people have their right to get upset. But at the same time, it's like I always go back to this, you know, as upset as I might get over Shaft being a comedy, or someone might get upset that Johnny Storm is going to be black, or that Jimmy Olsen is now Jenny Olsen, whatever it might be, it's like, yo, cops just killed someone in Chicago the other day. You know,
right.
There's too many people in prison. People are starving. You know, we live on a planet that's 70% water, and there's a water shortage everywhere. There's some very real stuff that we should be up in arms about. And talking about, in addition to talking about the things that we have fun with. I think some people spend too much time worrying about the pop culture stuff and not about the culture and not about the world that we live in, and you know, head buried in the sand just a little bit too much.
Amen. Oh, I brought a question there.
Not to get too deep, sorry, you know.
Nah. Now you need to take that same energy and apply that, and let's revamp Black Lightning while we're at it. All right, let's make that happen. I'm starting a petition today.
There'll be some interesting stuff. I'll have to come back, you know, in the future, and especially after some new projects I'm working on, when I can talk about them. There's stuff I can't talk about right now. And, yeah, we'll just have to come back and we can get into some stuff later.
Yeah.
And, just one last question, David. To wrap this whole thing up. The journey you've taken throughout popular culture, and you know, right now you're transitioning, or you've made the transition rather, from simply commenting on it and being a connoisseur to being a creator of it. How painful has that evolution been? Has it been a loss of innocence in a way?
Oh yeah. You know, most change is painful, you know, especially when it's a major change. But there's this, you know, you have to become aware of the business side of things, and you have to become aware of the marketing side of things, and the realities of it all, you know, and that in and of itself is really difficult. But you know, there comes a point when you're watching movies or reading comics, when you make the decision to be a critic, to really be a critic, and to really delve into the history of it, because it's not just enough to write about what you thought of one movie. You need to understand movies as an industry and as a medium. And the more you study it, the more it, you know, especially in a lot of regards, it becomes disheartening. You understand the politics of it all. You understand how it chews people up and spits them out. I was on another podcast last week, and I was talking about this, and I said, the movie Love Jones, which came out in 1997, I thought was a brilliant film when I saw it. I haven't seen it in a long time, but I loved it at the time.
Yes.
The cat who wrote and directed Love Jones has not made another movie since. And I think that reality is the real reality of entertainment and showbiz, is that some people get chewed up and spit out. Because if you had told me, I didn't realize this until very recently. I was doing research for something, and I was like trying to find black directors, trying to find women directors to see where their careers had gone. And I believe his name is Theodore Witcher, who did Love Jones. And I was like, yo, this guy hasn't done a movie since. And there has to be a reason why. But all of us right now on this show, and most of the people listening to the show, have to look the very realistic possibility that whatever that something was, part of it has to deal with race.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's rare that a movie can be that well received and make as much money as Love Jones did, and that the filmmaker never gets to do anything again. And I think that once you become a real serious critic, once you become, you know, a historian, if you will, you begin to understand that stuff. You begin to see it more, and that makes it makes you a little bit more cynical. And for me, it pushed me even harder to become creative, because I was like, I see these things that I don't like. Let me try to create something. Let me try to contribute to the world, as opposed to just, you know, talking about what I see being wrong with it.
And I think that's a great note, a great note to wrap this discussion on. David, thank you very much. This has been, I think, if not the best episode we've ever done, the best show we've ever done. I think it's damn close.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
Yes, and that's mainly due to your presence here. Thanks, man, and definitely the show's going to be going on hiatus for the next few months. But when I get it back up and running, you will definitely be welcome here anytime.
Cool, I appreciate it, man.
Absolutely.
And again, I'm going to be looking forward to your products. I'm going to keep buying Cyborg. I'm looking forward to anything you do in the future with Shaft or with DC or with Marvel or whoever it is you work with. But, yeah, man, thank you.
Thank you. I'll talk to you soon, man.
All right, peace.
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 Peace. Thank you.
Yep.
All All right, so we have an extra 20 minutes to fill up here because I didn't know exactly how long the discussion was going to run and how long we were going to have David for, but we were lucky to have him for the time that we did, and I think it was more than substantial.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, we
need
covered
another
a lot
word.
Of
I said that like three times.
That's okay. That's a catchphrase.
Choose another word next time.
You know, that's gonna be a catchphrase. That's all. We know it's good when you come with absolutely. So that's all that matters. You know,
absolutely.
It's all good. It's good. Yeah, you know, it's all good.
So, E. Hill, being that you're a novice to this area of pop culture, as you said, what after having talked to Eric to David Walker, What's your impression? What are you thinking right now?
I'm thinking there is a thoughtfulness to how the art and the storylines are developed that I wasn't really privy to. He's the first person who actually is, you know, involved in the creation and distribution of a comic. So him and someone else, but that we've had on the show before, and I've learned that, you know, you don't just sit around and draw stuff and then write as you go. I mean, it's a very iterative process, very collaborative process, and I enjoyed getting his take on that, as well as some of the things that helped influence the development of the characters that he's writing about. So it's great.
And Rowdy, as a DC fan, what are your thoughts on this?
I mean, as I think E. Hill kind of summed it up, in terms of, and you mentioned it too, you know, where we were, whoever is listening, you know, you got that peek, you know, of how the machine works. For some of us who are comic book fans, we have an idea of how the machine works, you know, the behind the scenes. But to hear it from David Walker, who's doing it, not only doing it, he's doing it at a high level, especially with the Cyborg run and the success he's had with Shaft. It's like, okay, you know, you really see what type of thought process, what the thought process is really all about, and you get an understanding of how he comes about certain things in terms of his writing and presenting the story. You know, the story. You know, especially with these two characters. You know, I'll tell you, it's always eye-opening because, you know, you always get a fresh take from whatever writer you may come across and get to hear him speak and their thought process. And you really get a feeling that he takes a lot of things into consideration, social issues, race, gender, mm-hmm. things of that nature, which are all hot button topics nowadays within the last few years or so. You see that he takes these things into consideration and the importance of it. And, you know, while it is fictional, there's still a message that's coming across in some way, shape, or form. So, I mean, that's the most important, you know, that's one of the things that I definitely, you know, got from tonight's, you know, show or interview. And then just to get sheer fact to get the chance to talk to him, especially after having read Becoming Black, you know, that's just one of those books that is so great and it's just so informative and so educational, especially for those of us who are, you know, in the pop culture, into the comics and into films. You know, it really speaks major, major, major volume. And, you know, it's highly recommended, as we've, you know, done thus far on this show. But, you know, you take into consideration, you know, our listeners and fan base, you know, it's one of those books that you want to make sure you let people know it, you know, it's out there, and that if you even have a lick of sense and knowledge, that it's something that you really need to take in, you know, and partake in reading.
Absolutely.
There we go. That's a thumbs up. That's a seal of approval. When E-Hill comes with the absolutely.
Absolutely.
That's when you know it's all good.
I'm going to copyright that.
You should.
I just wanted to add, though, I really enjoyed that there weren't, like, these platitudinous comments on if you work hard, you'll get it done, and, you know, you know, my journey was great, and I thought it was a very authentic discussion about this transition from critic to artist, or I guess that's not, you know, the appropriate dichotomy, but from being a critic of the work to actually producing and creating the work. And I think that for people who are listening, I think that's an important concept to grasp, is that you'll stand up and fall down a lot. And, you know, there are times when the transition is painful, and why there, you know, the reasons why are varied and personal. But I did appreciate the honesty about that, for sure.
Okay, now this is going to be kind of a, you know, this week has kind of been the Straight Outta Compton show on Scott Scope, which is never really intended. I'm a huge N.W.A., Dre, and Ice Cube fan, and I like the movie a lot, and I recommend people go see it, and I'm sick of talking about it now. So this will be the last question for a good long while, or the last statement made about anything related to this movie. E-Hill, being that we had that special show last night and the movie review show on Tuesday, given what David Walker had to say about the furor and the controversy surrounding this movie, how did you feel about his response?
I thought it was balanced. I thought it was an authentic response. And I thought it was a way to initiate the conversation about the bigger issues surrounding the group and the movie and the culture and the like. After that show, I did have occasion to speak with my mom about it, and my mother, who is also an academic and is closer to these issues and the scholarship surrounding them than I am. And what we kind of came up with is there are so many layers, and the issues surrounding the people on seemingly opposite sides is so multifactorial, and people are trying to boil it down into these camps, and it's really not an appropriate way to move the conversation forward about how women are treated within the context of a larger issue such as music or sports or social justice. I mean, these questions have lingered for, you know, decades, and they've been approached in all these different ways. But it's really what continues to escape us, in my view, is a starting point for everybody to kind of take a deep breath and say, you know, what's the real? Because we're just kind of bringing this up as things come up. And it really detracts from the overarching themes that span across these different domains and have for a long time. So I thought that he spoke to that, which I haven't heard aside from the people on the show and save a few people in my close circles and in my Facebook friend circles, really, really speak to that aspect of it, as opposed to the legacy of NWA and, you know, what these particular aspects of the movie spoke to and left out and blah, 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 because it'll happen again. It'll come up again. The next sports person, the next musician, the next whatever. And so I think moving forward, what I would want to see is really starting the conversation with a set of questions that keep popping up and really, really in a meaningful and intentional way attacking what those issues are outside of whatever sports figure or music figure or figures we're talking about.
And with that, the book on Straight Outta Compton and everything to do with it on Scottscope is now closed. Officially closed. Unless we're just having a straight up discussion about something music related with those guys, this discussion is going to be tabled. Because I think we've pretty much covered as much ground as we can with this. And, you know, and it's a shame because on Monday night show, we really didn't get to do the movie its due, give the movie its due, and to really discuss it as a film, mm-hmm. and to really, you know, get into its merits as a film, because that's another shame about this whole thing, is that the movie itself and the question of how do you properly immortalize icons of any cult, of any medium or culture, that question kind of got lost in all this other discussion about the related issues. But that speaks to David Walker's point about how we keep only attacking this from one or two angles as opposed to looking at it and it standing back and looking at it in its totality and having an open, broad, and honest discussion about all of it.
Well, what'll be interesting to see is what Don Cheadle does with this Miles Davis biopic. And we know what he's done in his past, in his personal past, as well as his contributions to jazz. And so it'll be interesting to see how that is treated in the biopic.
Well, one thing I got to say, and I think that Rowdy can vouch for me on this, because Rowdy, you know, I know Rowdy doesn't consider himself a movie guy like me, but I know Rowdy has picked up on this. Biopics, by and large, and if you want to, you could even look at Goodfellas as, in a sense, a biopic, because it's telling you about the true story of Henry Hill and his criminal career as I think he was an associate of the Lucchese family, Cosa Nostra family in New York. You know, and Goodfellas is considered to be the realest and most authentic mafia movie ever made. That was the movie that introduced me to Scorsese and made me fall in love with his work. And it is, in many regards, on the Goodfellas DVD, every iteration they've done of that special edition of Goodfellas, there's a commentary track with the real Henry Hill, and I think one of either the DEA or ATF or FBI agents that chased him and built a case against him. Henry Hill said that the movie was about 85 or 90% accurate to what his life was. But even then, there were liberties taken in showing that story, because certain things have to be done for the sake of expediency. Certain things have to be done, you know, for the sake of what an audience can absorb and understand. Because, again, movies are not really, to be honest, a good vehicle for telling the quote-unquote real story. They're really not. That mission would be better served with a documentary or with a book or a series of documentaries and books, because with those things you can get multiple perspectives. I was reminded of the documentary, I think O'Diesel brought it up, the documentary that was recently done on, her name escapes me right now.
Nina Simone,
yes. I watched it, and that was the thing I noticed about it was that it gave multiple perspectives from her daughter, from people who worked with her. And, of course, I mean, even a documentary is biased because there's a hand guiding it. It has a director. It has an editor. And these people have a certain agenda, and they have to make everything fit a narrative, again, that people can absorb and understand. But at the same time, it gives you a more rounded picture than an adaptation or a biopic could ever give you. Because really what you're dealing with when you deal with biopics is a canonization of the canonizing the myth, who we believe these people, who these people are in the public popular consciousness. And that's different from who they actually are or what their work actually did in the real world. And my favorite, the greatest biopic ever made, Malcolm X, it's also the same thing. Spike Lee took liberties. There was the character of Baines in that movie. There was no Baines in real life. Malcolm was introduced to Islam or the Nation of Islam through, I think, his brother and a few other people. There was no character named Baines. And that movie was like, what, 3 hours, 3.5 hours? So there you see, even a three and a half hour span, you can't really tell the quote unquote real story. It's very difficult. So to put that on this movie was kind of unfair. At the same time, there are certain omissions, glaring omissions that do compromise the integrity of the film as a historical document, and that's where you get into problems.
Well, I think if people, it doesn't necessarily have to call for a full blown, you know, scene. I mean, and I think Selma would be the best example I can come up with, where there was a nod to Dr. King's infidelity without an open scene about it.
But it acknowledged it. Right. That's the thing. It acknowledged it.
Right. And that took what, 5 minutes? And I don't know how long it took to make it, but it took 5 minutes to watch it and get it. So I don't think that people necessarily call for, you don't have to have a whole what's love that to do with it kind of thing, where the whole movie is centered around this issue of domestic violence with Tina Turner, because it shaped a lot of who she was and how she reinvented herself. But I don't think every movie has to have that in order to acknowledge the personal flaws of these people. And you know, Nina Simone was flawed. And I don't know if that movie is going to get made with Zoe Saldana and all that. I haven't heard anything about it, but I think any documentary, any chronicling of somebody's life, they're going to be, I think it's cool and makes for more compelling watching for me to see at least some acknowledgement that this person was not a saint. This person had flaws. But at the end of the day, their contribution is still valid and relevant.
Right. And on that note, and at this juncture, I think it's kind of a good place to close out the show, because we have less than 2 minutes. Wow. We have less than 2 minutes to go before we sign off. E. Hill, Rowdy, thank you for helping me do this. You guys being here definitely helped everything go as well as it possibly could. You had some great questions for David, and I think you helped to make this a great experience for him and for us. So, you guys are part of the show. Shout outs to Old Diesel, who couldn't be here tonight, VQ, who couldn't be here tonight. Also Chicago Wind, who he was going to try to call in, but I guess his prior obligations kind of prevented him from doing that. But I think that this is, again, arguably, this is one for the record books, man. This is arguably the best show we've done yet.
Yeah,
and that,
it definitely
and that
is.
Yeah.
And coming so close to our hiatus, or let me say possible hiatus, because I don't know how things are going to work out over these next few months. I may be able to squeeze in some time to do a show here or there. I don't know. But for, you know, all intents and purposes, I'm just going to say we're going on hiatus. But anyway, thank you everybody for listening. Our next show is going to be with R.L. Scott, filmmaker R.L. Scott, who we already had on our show with the Almighty Street Team, or the guys behind that. And he's going to be talking about his new movie, Call Me King, which is going to be released in early September. Until that time, we out. Peace.
Peace.